Hi, this is Sean Green, former Blue Jay, and you're listening to the Walk-Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard Podcast for the casual fan.
And another one.
And good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Walk-Off on 365 Sportscast Radio Network. We are a Toronto Blue Jays-focused show. I'm Scott Belford, joined by Adam Mack.
Hello there.
How goes the battle, bud?
Oh, it's great. It's been rainy up here in Edmonton for the last 48 hours. And as a guy that gets pretty hot quite easily, I am in heaven.
You're all for these May showers that bring June flowers, which is how it works in Canada, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My wife is miserable, but I'm telling myself this must be what Vancouver Island feels like, and I am in paradise. So,
and here's the big thing about today's show. We have a heck of a guest with us, two-time All-Star Sean Green, formerly of the Toronto Blue Jays. He played for the Mets, he played for the Diamondbacks, and of course the Los Angeles Dodgers, where he still holds the season home run record for home runs in a single season with 49. Very excited to do to air that. Now, this interview is going to run about 55 minutes. So if for whatever reason you missed the end of it or you got to cut out for a few minutes, this full interview is going to be up in its entirety on our YouTube page, The Walk-Off Podcast, so you can check it out there. And of course, if while you're there, you subscribe, grateful. That's what we are, grateful. And of course, we are also doing our live stream that we do every single Tuesday after the show. So you can join us for that from our YouTube page as well. That live stream is going to be brought to you by yourrate.ca. Darren Brown is the mortgage broker there. He's going to help you out. Of course, interest rates are going up, but there are still a few lower rates that you can lock in now. That's yourrate.ca. So this series against Boston, bud. Whoo!
Big deal.
This has some playoff feel to it for its importance.
It does.
So the Boston Red Sox are in first place in the AL East, 25-17. The Toronto Blue Jays are second in the AL East, 22-17. Their two games are, I guess, a game and a half back of the Red Sox. So they could take the lead here with a sweep. They could be within half a game if they take two of three here.
So this is our first time playing the Red Sox this year, right?
This is our second time playing the Red Sox. Remember, they had that two-game series.
Right. We split that.
Split that. And the pitching looks good in this matchup for the Jays. I mean, we're actually using starters, which is something to say, you know?
Yeah.
So our ace, Ryu, starts the series off today, and then we go to Ross Stripling for tomorrow and Steven Matz in the getaway game. Should be interesting to see how this bullpen shapes up for the Blue Jays. Of course, injuries have been a major problem. Rafael Dolis is supposed to be back today.
David, the bullpen's overworked, man.
It's just overworked. There's no other way of saying it. The bullpen is overworked, and with these starters that we're seeing lined up for this series, the hope and the dream is that they can put in 5 to 6 innings. I know that's a low bar, but they really need to go 5 to 6 at least.
Yeah.
I know we got that out of Robbie Ray on Sunday, which, let's talk Robbie Ray for one real second here before we throw to Sean Green. But he pitched a heck of a game on Sunday. He got the win. I mean, it was a wild game, 10-8 win for the Reds, or for the Blue Jays there against who are we playing again? My brain just went blank.
Matt, I just zoned out too. The Phillies.
The Phillies, right. The Phillies. Oh, my goodness. Anyways, he was at 100 and some pitches and went back out for the sixth inning, which was great to see them push Ray a little bit.
Absolutely.
Anyways, all the best, or I guess not all the best, but enjoy the interview here of Sean Green. And yeah, every Tuesday we run our show 6 Eastern.
Burrows trying to steal third, and that one is belted to left center field, and that baby's gone.
Hi, this is Sean Green, former Blue Jay, and you're listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott and Adam.
So thrilled to be joined by today's guest, two-time All-Star, 1999 Silver Slugger and Gold Glove winner, former Blue Jay, Dodger, Diamondback, and Met, Sean Green. Welcome to the walk-off, man. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Buddy, we are pretty darn excited to talk some baseball with you here. How have you spent your last 14 months of craziness? Hopefully you and the family are staying safe and sane.
Yeah, no, it's been, I think tough on everyone in the world, but at the same time, there are some silver linings, like spending more time at home with the family and I guess focusing on things that are easy to lose sight of. So it's been nice in that regard, but I'm looking forward to getting past this, which it seems like we're getting closer and closer each day.
Thank goodness. It has not been like you said, silver lining. Yeah, there's positives you can take out of this, but I didn't need to learn that pandemics suck. I could have just read about that,
That's right.
So we're going to get a little nostalgic here to start things off, Sean. I was 11 in 1993. Of course, Blue Jays baseball was my entire life. Turns out at 11, I had a lot of time to obsess about baseball. And I remember your 1993 September call-up very well because I knew that team inside and out. They're all a bunch of veterans, and all of a sudden a homegrown within the organization rookie comes up. What was that experience like for you to be on a team in 93 that had just won a World Series in 92 and get your first taste of the big leagues?
Yeah, no, it was a big thrill to come up because a lot of those guys were players that I idolized. I mean, my favorite player when I was your age at that time was Ricky Henderson because I lived in the Bay Area for a while, and he was – came up and was stealing all the bases, breaking records. So he was on that team, and I got to watch Devon White when I moved down to Southern California when he was in the Angels. And of course, Alomar and Joe Carter, all these great players were there. So it was kind of a surreal experience to get to play with some of your heroes, especially when, I was at the time, I was, 20 years old. So it was amazing. And then to get to watch them go on to win the World Series, even though I was only there a couple weeks. But I knew those guys from spring training, and it was a great group of guys. But I came up with some other young guys like Carlos Delgado, and we had a good thing going in the minor leagues. So I had fun, I had fun there. But it was nothing like getting a chance to put on that big league uniform.
Like you said, you didn't play a lot at the end of that 93 year. What was it like to receive the 93 World Series ring and get that hardware? What were your thoughts and emotions kind of as a 21-year-old rookie to get that?
Yeah, well, I was in AAA Syracuse when I got the ring. I think there's maybe four of us or so that got the ring there. And, it was super cool. But at the time, I didn't necessarily appreciate how hard it is to get one of those because I never got another one.
Yeah, right.
So. It was kind of a one and done for me, but it was, it's cool. It's a cool thing to have. It's not like I, contributed at all to that championship, but at the same time, it's still something that I have and will always cherish.
It's interesting too, because then the next year, like 1994 hits and the labor dispute eventually took the baseball season in the MLB. And I mean, you were kind of working to establish yourself as a major leaguer still at that point. You won minor league player of the year for the Jays. Where was your head at the time with the work stoppage? And I'm curious how, when you look back on that now, 27 years later, how you still feel about that stoppage?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a bizarre time for me because I was, I was kind of caught in the middle of this, something that had been brewing for years and years, between the players and the owners, and I was sort of just stepping into the mix. So it was kind of a weird thing, but Carlos Delgado started up in the big leagues playing left field. Excuse me, I was in Syracuse and got off to a great start. He had a bunch of home runs in April, but then struggled, and so he got sent down. I got called up, and then I struggled, and I got sent down. And I think had there not been the strike, I think a few of us would have spent a little bit more time there because the strike happened in August and we definitely would have been there in September. But we all kind of convened in Syracuse and got to the championship game, which was pretty cool because ESPN aired it since there was no Major League Baseball that year. So that was, it was kind of a big deal for us to be, you know, the focal point of, you know, baseball in America at that time. But yeah, no, the strike was, it was a tough situation because I, you know, I was still in limbo. Am I going to make it to the big league team in the spring, or, you know, what's my situation? You know, personally, and I remember that spring, you know, we were, you know, spring training was shut down and I was trying to figure out, when should I go to Florida? Is it, every time it got close to being done, or the rumors that, okay, we're going to come to an agreement, you know, I was tempted that maybe I should hop on a plane, just get there and hang out, 'cause I wanted to be there so badly. I eventually did do that when it was, you know, pretty certain that we were, you know, days away from ending the strike and the lockout at that point.
So when you look at now, 2021, and obviously the MLB and the MLBPA are, the relationship is strained, let's put it. Do you think that there's a possibility of a labor stoppage this 2022 season? Like, do you think that baseball could wind up doing it again?
I think it's very unlikely, but there's always that possibility, just because of the nature of the negotiations between, you know, the owners and players. It's always a challenge, and you know, I think as long as, you know, neither side is digging their heels in too hard on a very important issue, then it should be fine. I would imagine, you know, in light of what the world's been going through over the last 14 months, that you know, cooler heads will prevail, and enough money was lost, you know, for both sides over the last year. So I would imagine they'll figure something out, but you know, I would never bet the farm.
Never put it past baseball, right?
Right. Well, I mean, it's just like that in other sports as well. You know, it's challenging. You know, there's a lot of money at stake, and you know, you're, as owners, that you're competing against players that are, in their nature, are very competitive and are, you know, used to, you know, going all in to win. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens, but I would imagine that, you know, they'll figure something out.
Well, I hope you're right, my man. Fingers crossed on that. So let's go back again. 1998. And I honestly, man, it's so funny, as a Jays fan, I still think about that team. I still think it might literally be the best Jays team of all time, which I know sounds crazy, being they won the World Series in 92, 93. And it kills me that 98 team finished third in the AL East. I mean, my goodness, man, you look at that pitching staff, Roger Clemens. And let's put Roger aside for a second, because Kelvin Escobar was absolutely phenomenal that year and doesn't get enough credit. Chris Carpenter, you became a household name around Canada, stealing 35 bases, hitting 35 bombs. Carlos Delgado, Jose Canseco, like literally the offense was insane. How good was that 1998 Blue Jays team?
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I was doing an interview at one point a couple months ago, and you know, I think that was the best team that I was on, and I think that team, that was the best Yankees team that year, I believe, like in 98, I think, was their best team. And I really think they were praying we didn't get to the postseason, because I feel like we swept them in September in, you know, maybe in Yankee Stadium, but we had their number, and we just didn't realize how good we were until about, I would say, probably July or August. And all of a sudden we were cruising the second half of the season. Like you said, you know, Clemens won the Cy Young, but Carpenter and Escobar, I think, were better pitchers the second, you know, last 2 months of the year. So we had those three guys, like, to have a short series and face those three guys. And then don't forget the last day of the season, Roy Halladay came up and almost threw a perfect game, right? No hitter with two outs in the ninth. The only guy that reached base that day was an error. So, I mean, he basically, you know, came out and gave us a foreshadow of, you know, what he was going to be about. But yeah, no, that, the other thing about that team is we had Shannon Stewart, you know, raking and stealing bases. So we had speed. I mean, Canseco stole 29 bases. As you said, I stole 35. I don't know. And Shannon stole a bunch. I don't know how many he stole. So we had power, we had speed, we had the starting pitching. Our bullpen was our only area that wasn't rock solid. I mean, we had Quantrill, who was, you know, great. but that was the one area that was maybe a little shaky. But that said, you know, I think in a short series in the postseason, that team goes really far.
So that is 98 one of those years that you look back on and you're like, huh, that's too bad. That was a close one.
Yeah, but I do. I think it was coming out of, you know, the previous 3 years, we were never in the mix, right? 95, 6, and 7, we were, you know, we had some good talent, but we had some gaping holes in those teams. And all of a sudden, 98, I think sometimes it just takes a beat for you to figure out, wait a second, we're actually really good. And if you play with that confidence, like I said, if there was 10 more games, I think we go to the postseason. We got knocked out on the last Friday of the year, you know, season ending on Sunday. So we got knocked out on a Friday, and, you know, 10 more games, you know, we go to the postseason, and, you know, I think it'd be really interesting at that point.
Yeah, no, I remember that year so well. And I remember even getting knocked out and just being so excited that you guys just turned it on so much at the end of the year, you know,
exactly.
Like it really went from thinking that, you know, it could be another 1997 to all of a sudden being like, wow, this team is legit. So,
yeah. And it was it was a really fun team because, you know, the older guard had left. And so now it was all of a sudden, you know, it was our team, the younger players. And, you know, granted we had, you know, some legendary veterans there like Canseco and Clemens and guys like that. But really the heartbeat of the team was the young core that we had, which, you know, a lot of people were excited about the young core, but we were sort of being suppressed, you know, for a few years. And, mm-hmm. And then we kind of had, all of a sudden we took over and that was the culture of the team. If you remember when everyone dyed their hair blonde and, you know, there's all these like, yeah. You know, it was just a fun team.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know. And it's funny, man, because I was a big fan of yours in that era, you know, like I was 16 and I was just like, yeah, Sean Green's going to take us to the promised land. And I was just looking up your numbers and I had forgotten like how dominant, like 1999, man, you had a monster year in every aspect. Like, and I mean, defensively too, gold glove in the field, right? Like silver slugger award, 42 dingers, 45 doubles, 123 RBIs in your first all-star appearance. It was kind of your coming out party as an elite player in the league. What was that experience like to kind of become the star of the team? And do you remember things about your first all-star game appearance?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was, yeah. So for me, 98 was when, I think I, you know, the first time I got a chance to play every day, and I had a manager that believed in me. I had veteran players like Canseco and Clemens that were, you know, kind of making comments to me throughout the year that, that how much potential they thought I, you know, how they thought I was going to be, you know, a really good player. So that to have guys that I had posters on my wall as a kid, believing me, have a manager now that's playing me every day, hitting me, you know, second or third in the lineup. It was just a different mindset, right? So going into 99, I had 98 behind me and had kind of taken it to the next level. And so 99, it's kind of a strange spring. You know, Tim Johnson got fired and they brought in Fregosi. But Fregosi, same thing. He believed in me. When I got hit by a pitch against Andy Pettit, and broke this little bone right here. And, you know, he was just crushed. And to have, you know, a manager that wanted me in there so badly. And, you know, I was like begging on, just don't put me on the DL. The doctor said it could be, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks. So don't put me on. And so he didn't put me on the DL. And yeah, for me, I think it's, you know, I would get from kind of that point on, I would get really streaky in my career. And that year was the one time. Yeah, other than maybe the first week or 10 days of the season, I basically was hot, you know, most of the year. Yeah, I had a July, I think I had hit every game in July, like a 28 game hitting streak. And that's just kind of how I became a hitter, that once I kind of found that groove, then I would get locked in. And for some reason that year just lasted much longer time than other years. And you know, I had great hitters around me. I had Shannon, well, Homer Bush was hitting ninth, hitting 300, stealing 40 bases, whatever. And Jen Stewart's leading off. So every time I'm up to bat, I got some guys a threat to steal on base. I'm getting more fastballs, and I got Delgado behind me. And then Tony Fernandez had hit 400, you know, up to the All-Star break, basically.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was a really great mentor. And he, you know, he taught me a lot from spring training on, just taught me a lot about hitting. So I was really comfortable. You know, I loved a lot of the coaching staff. Like Gary Matthews was a hitting coach. He was awesome. Jim Lett was, threw batting practice to us, and Carlos and I had a lot of fun in batting practice and started, you know, trying to compete against each other, hitting home runs to center field. And that's kind of, you know, all that stuff kind of added up together. And when you're really comfortable and you're feeling good, it's a lot easier to perform. And so then you asked about the All-Star game. Yeah. So when I got hit by that pitch against Pettitte, that was early June. And, you know, I was, I think, second in league in home runs at the time and hitting 320, 330, something like that. So I was feeling like, oh, I'm a shoo-in to make my first All-Star team. And then all of a sudden I break this little bone in my hand. And then, you know, I was pretty devastated. You know, obviously I didn't want to miss any games, but also that was kind of lurking because it was getting close to All-Star game. I ended up missing about 2 weeks, tried to play after a week, came back, and, you know, got caught pretty quickly and had a good little stretch and then ended up making the All-Star game. And went to Boston, and it was pretty incredible because at Boston it was 1999, so it was all the best players that were still alive of the century, really the history of baseball, right? So getting a chance to meet Ted Williams and, you know, see Willie Mays and all these players was, you know, as a guy who grew up a huge fan, like that was, you know, that was definitely the ultimate.
Kind of tapping into that the kid Sean Green, eh? When you wind up and all those guys are there, unreal.
Yeah, no, and it's funny because they had the ceremony had started and I was still in the clubhouse because I was so excited just to talk to the current stars, you know, like that I admired, and you know, as a player, when the stars that you still look up to, your contemporaries, when they're great players and you want to pick their brains and you know, talk baseball, talk hitting. And so I was doing that, and then someone said, hey, what's going on right now out in the field? So we all ran out there and got a chance to see, you know, the second half of the ceremony when all the players were around the field and they were, you know, talking about their history in the game.
So you became an All-Star in 1999. And I mean, just the numbers alone got the Jays fan base just so excited, obviously, like the potential that it seemed like you have. And like you mentioned too, you hit the injury list there for a couple weeks. So like you start looking at 42 home runs and you're like, what does this guy have in the tank? And then you wound up getting traded to LA, which, I mean, devastated me and it devastated the Blue Jays fan base. But at the same time, I'm sure a wide range of emotions for you. You just were traded from your only team you've been on, but you were also traded back to California where your home was, right? To go back to go to the Dodgers there. Tell me about that experience. Your first major league trade.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I never expected to leave. So what happened was, it was that very end of the year and I had a great year and I was a year away from free agency. And so my agent said to me, he said, hey, you know, the Jays either want to sign you to a long-term deal or trade you. And at the time the Jays were up for sale, right? We couldn't just spend that little bit extra to get, you know, the one player we need, the one pitcher we need or whatever to get over that hump. And, you know, I was worried, like, you know, if they sign me, will they be able to sign Carlos or like, what is that going to mean? So there's a lot of questions. So basically I said, I'm not going to sign a long-term deal right now. There's too much uncertainty. And so assuming that's, you guys are going to trade me, these are the teams that, you know, I'd want to go to. And the reason I had that kind of leverage in terms of what teams was because someone's not going to want to trade at that time. Maybe it's different now because people value prospects in a different way, but at that time, they're not going to trade a player somewhere or trade their prospects for a player that's going to walk in a year. So they want to, so you get a 72-hour window to negotiate a long-term deal. So that's kind of how it unfolded. It sort of just came out of nowhere. And I think the team, you know, having had Alomar you know, walk, and, you know, not getting anything in return. I think that was maybe kind of what set that up. But, you know, once that was thrown out there, then we kind of ran with the trade, and that's what happened. And, you know, I always expected, to stay a Blue Jay, you know, my whole career. And I love the fans there and I love my teammates. And Gord Ash was always really good to me. I liked Gord a lot. I mean, I definitely, the first 3 years I was in Toronto, you know, were very frustrating because I felt like I should have had a chance to, I felt like I kept proving that I should be an everyday player and I just wasn't getting that chance. But you know, I still absolutely loved my experience in Toronto. So then it all kind of unfolds. There's different rumors about teams that I was going to get traded to. And I end up, you know, my agent also represented Raul Mondesi, who was disgruntled in LA. And so it seemed like it all kind of worked out and I get to go back to LA and play at home. So, you know, I was pretty excited. It was kind of weird to go to spring training and not, you know, have all my boys there and have that comfort level.
Being the new kid on the block, eh?
Yeah, being the new kid on the block, and you assigned a big deal. So now it's like, okay, I got to show all these people, you know, how I play. You know, especially you couldn't get any further from the AL East to the NL West, right? So
legit.
Yeah. So you know, I had a number of, you know, kind of added pressures. You know, being home and playing is a little harder. As a Jewish player and being in a big Jewish market where Sandy Koufax played, that added, you know, another level of pressure. And then the Dodgers were, you know, they were spending a bunch of money and expecting to win. They had just signed the year before Kevin Brown for, you know, over $100 million, which I think was the largest contract at the time. So that there was these added pressures that were different than playing, you know, had I stayed in Toronto. And at first, you know, I got off to a good start. And then, you know, I just sort of, you know, I started struggling. I wasn't hitting enough home runs in my mind. So I think about 2 months of the season, I was hitting over 300. But I had, you know, maybe 10 home runs. So I was looking, geez, last year at this time I had, you know, closer to 20 home runs. You know, I'm slacking. I got to start hit some home runs. And then I just, you know, kind of start spiraling downward and ended up having, you know, it wasn't a terrible year. I had, you know, hit 24 home runs with 99 RBIs, but, you know, it wasn't what they had expected. So I, you know, that was a tough, you know, kind of reset for me. You know, it was weird because I always lived in California in the off season, and now I'm living and playing in the same place. So it's like, yeah, I would wake up in my, you know, in my bed, and it felt like it was the off season because I was at home. So it's just like it was a weird transition for me that I think it's hard to understand unless you're playing. But Toronto for me was baseball. Like I go there, you know, I'm in my apartment, like I'm here to play baseball, and that was the feeling. So I had to try to merge those two worlds, and I think it took a little time to kind of sort everything out.
That's really interesting that moving to LA, you had to develop a whole new mental approach to the game again.
Yeah, no, it is. It's strange because baseball is so much about like how you're feeling and being in the right. Yeah, it's weird. Like you go to certain cities and you know, you feel good walking in the stadium or the hotels, you know, restaurants. And that was the other thing going to National League. I didn't know these cities. I didn't even know how to get into the stadium in a lot of places. Like, where do I go? I felt like a rookie. You know, yeah. It's true. It's now all of a sudden you don't have that comfort level. Whereas, you know, in the American League, I'd walk into Cleveland and I loved hitting there. So like, oh, I love, as soon as we get to the hotel in Cleveland, I feel good because it's a place I love to hit, you know? And so I felt like a rookie again. And I felt like, you know, there's these added things that I had to, you know, I had to prove myself out.
So I know you mentioned that in 2000, when you first went to the Dodgers, you had what you thought was a down year home run wise. And then in 2001, you kind of corrected that, right? Hitting 49 bombs with the Dodgers, which to this day is still the home run record for a single season by a Los Angeles Dodger. What was it about that year that kind of got you back on that home run path that you were on before? And what does it take to hit those kind of power numbers?
Yeah, I mean, it was, it was weird. Like I got off to a decent start. I mean, the first half of the year, I actually didn't make the All-Star team that year. I mean, I hit 20 home runs before the break. You know, that they started, you know, coming on more like as they got closer to the break. But then I hit 29 after the break. So I just kind of found my swing again. I think I got my swing got really long, and I was trying to like hook everything. The first year, my strength, which I worked on with Delgado a lot, was driving the ball to the middle of the field. And we used to try to hit it off the windows restaurant batting practice or over into the restaurant. That was the ultimate, which we did a couple times each, but that was my strength. And all of a sudden now I'm in this new park in LA. It's a little harder to hit home runs in LA. It's a, you know, you get the marine layer and it's, you know, it just doesn't carry as well as it does in some other parks. So now I'm trying to, you know, hook the ball a little bit more and swinging harder, and you just get in a bad groove. And then all of a sudden in 01, I sort of like figured out, found that same swing that I had in Toronto. And and I just gotten some really good streaks, especially after the All-Star break. I got pretty hot and had, you know, I think I had a stretch where over, you know, 8 or 9 games, I hit 10 home runs or something like that, you know, whatever it was. So I had a couple of those, had a 3-homer game, and
the bat trick, yeah, as Canadians call it.
The bat trick. Yeah. 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 So I don't know. It's just, you know, things just, I just sort of found it. And once I got hot, then it stayed there.
So I'm going to bring up a stat here. And it's going to come full circle. So I'm not just bringing up this up as like a diss or anything, but
no, you're good.
You struck out 107 times in 2001, and that's the year you hit 49 home runs, which, if you were to look at today, is legitimately crazy good. I mean, to put it in perspective here, so the guy who's leading strikeouts right now in the league is Joey Gallo with the Texas Rangers.
Makes sense. Through
36 games, he has 6 home runs and 53 strikeouts. So half of what you had in less than a quarter of the season. How do you feel about where baseball is at right now with the fact that every outcome seems to be a home run, a strikeout, or a walk?
Yeah, I mean, I don't love the style, the approach of hitters right now in general, right? There's a lot of incredible hitters. And I like the thought of, we tried to, you know, move the ball around the field, and guys before me, like that was always that's how you were taught. And it seems like now it's like, okay, let's hit the ball as far as we can in the air, which I tried to do too. I mean, my plan was to try to drive the ball in the air to center field, but if things were going bad, or, you know, you get 2 strikes and then it's, you know, you shorten it up, you know, if they're shifting, then try to, you know, find holes. Like, I think there was a plan that was, it was not about as much, is about trying to work with what you have right there. So if you're in a situation, you need to get a guy over, you need to hit a fly ball or whatever it is, like you're trying to play to win the game. Right. And it wasn't, you know, just trying to launch the ball in the air. And I think, you know, and these players they're incredible athletes, incredible hitters. I think they try to go after what is expected of them, what people want. So if people want home runs, they're going to go after home runs. And I think it's gotten a little bit away from, the style of game's changed. And I think if you ask most former players, would probably say they liked the way it was before, but, you know, at the same time, you don't want to sound like a former player that's, you know, grouchy and like,
yeah, crotchety old man. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I miss stolen bases, you know, in fact, they're not as many of them now. I was talking earlier when I was in Toronto and had Shannon Stewart and all these guys and Homer Bush and Jose Cruz and everyone's running and stealing. It just, you got better pitches to hit, and it changed the dynamic. Right. And, you know, it moved the fielders around. I just think there's a balance, and I understand a lot of the new age stuff is probably super helpful, but if it goes too extreme to one side, then you lose some of the other more subtle nuances of the game that add things that maybe are a little harder to to quantify, right? And yeah.
Well, I really like what you're saying here, because in all honesty, man, and I was going to kind of bring this up, because when I was a kid and I look back on the game, yeah, I loved home runs. Of course I did. But it wasn't the be-all and end-all, honestly, and I know you kind of touched on it. What got me the most excited, and even to this day, is a stolen base. In fact, I just heard they did a poll, Theo Epstein did, as they're, you know, they're trying to fix baseball, but at least they're looking into it. And they polled a bunch of fans, and the things that the fans liked the most, triple ranked number one, double number two, stolen base number three. And last in 2019, it was the lowest amount of triples ever in baseball. The lowest amount of doubles since 1992. And stolen bases just haven't been the same since pretty much the 80s, I guess. So if you look at that, like, it's pretty crazy to think that fans' favorite aspect of the game are the ball and movement, and, you know, watching guys take an extra base when maybe they shouldn't take that extra 90 feet. And it's all home runs. That's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think, you know, it sounds like, I don't know what the situation is with the ball this year, but it seems like home runs are down a little bit. Or is that, is that right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think teams that are used to winning games by hitting a lot of home runs might be struggling more, because all of a sudden that's how the team is designed. And then if the ball changes a little bit and those balls are going, you know, to the warning track, it's going to be a lot harder to win games.
Well, you're a guy that took a lot of bases. You were on that Jays team that was just filled with base thieves. What is it that, what's the mentality of a base stealer? Like, what makes a good base runner when you're out there? And why is that? Obviously the manager is putting some red lights out there, right? Not to get thrown out on the base. But what is it that is so different between when you were out there stealing bases and the approach players are taking these days?
Yeah, I just think they're just not allowed to run, really. And there's a couple things that make it harder now. I think there's, seems like, you know, guys are throwing really hard and they throw more fastballs. So it's, you know, for me, I wasn't as fast as Shannon Stewart. And, you know, as a tall, lanky guy, it's really the harder part is getting those first couple steps. Because, you know, someone like Shannon is more built, he's built more like a, you know, like a football player, and he can get to full speed probably in 2 steps, where it took me maybe 4 or 5 steps to get to full speed. So I think for me, I was more focused on trying to pick a good pitch to hit. So sometimes you're at first and your eyes, you know, you kind of like go like this and try to see what the catcher's signs are. You know, if you see more than one finger, then you know it's not gonna be a fastball. And so sometimes I would do that, and I'd pick pitchers that, you know, we knew what their times were to first, or to, sorry, times to home. So I would pick spots that I thought I had a good chance to make it, and that's what I would do. And with Carlos up behind me, a lot of times, like my, you know, 99, I didn't steal as much because I'm not gonna pick the bat out of Carlos's hands and have him walk him, right? Whereas in 98, I was hitting second, and then I had Canseco and then Delgado. So for me to get to second and have, they're not gonna walk the two big sluggers behind me.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, hopefully they do. That'd be great. And we'll have Tony Fernandez up. But so, yeah, a lot of it is, and like teams just now, they're, a lot of them just aren't built. They're just not, they're not built around speed at all. So it's not like, you know, people always complain, like, why don't guys bunt when there's a shift on? It's like, well, that's, they just don't do it. So they're not going to be successful trying to bunt if they never bunt. Right.
Right. If you never practice it, you don't get better at it.
Yeah, it's kind of, and that's something I have, that's a problem I have sometimes with teams in the postseason, is all of a sudden they'll get to the postseason and it's like a key situation, and they might try to have a, you know, play more situationally, and it's like, if you don't do that all year, you're not gonna, it's gonna be really hard to do it when all the pressure's on in the postseason, right? So yeah, that's something I don't know, I just feel like I look at the Red Sox, and I played with Alex Cora for 5 years in LA, and he's a really smart baseball guy. And I feel like they play more of an old school game, and the fact that he was gone and they struggled and then he comes back and they're back in first place, I think there's something to it.
100%. And yeah, the Red Sox are turning heads this year and no one expected it. And you're right. They are playing a more old school style of baseball. It's fun to watch. All right, my man, I need to get to listener questions here or we're going to get a bunch of crap from them. So
all right.
we'll switch gears here. This first one is from Juan in Toronto, and he says, "Hey, Sean, loved you in a Jays jersey. Who was the biggest clubhouse character you ever played with, and what made that guy stand out in your memories?"
So character is, yeah, so that's different than, you know, who's the best teammate, who are the best teammates on. I think a character was our closer, Randy Myers. Like, that guy was a trip. But he'd wear camos all the time. And then every game he'd sit in his camos and his, you know, he'd have a big sausage he'd just be eating, or a big salami. He'd just be like slicing it with his machete and eating salami. I think supposedly he was hiding grenades in. It's just like, oh, yeah. He was a trip. I probably shouldn't say too much or I'll, you know, have to watch out for my house. But, yeah, and he would get on the mound. I don't know if you remember that, how stressful it was. Really stressful. He'd save a lot of games, but it was always, you know, a nail biter. If it was a 2-run lead, then bases would get loaded, the winning runs on, and all of a sudden there's a double play or something. But, you know, he'd get out there and he'd move all that. He'd look at me in the outfield, he'd move me, he'd move everyone. He's like, you know, like, just, you know, I got, we already went over the scouting report, so you do your thing. I know where to go. But he was definitely, I think, the biggest character that I played with in Toronto.
That's great. Before we carry on with the listener questions here, I know Adam has one here for you, so we might as well get that in now.
So golf, the PGA has the Champions Tour for pro golfers 50 plus. Do you think that a Champions League for baseball would be successful at all? Maybe for 40 or 45 year olds and older, right? Such as yourself. And follow up to that, would you play in it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually a good idea. I think there's been a couple times where they're trying to get like alumni type games with that type of, you know, 45 year olds. I think it could be fun if it's done right, and I think fans would like it. I mean, you probably could speak more to that than I could, but yeah, if there was a cool setup that it was not too big of a commitment where it's, you know, you're not playing 162 right, games or something like that.
Schedule, yeah. More, yeah. Off days, maybe 8 to 10 teams.
Yeah. Yeah. If it was like, you know, call it like a 6-week season or something like that. Like, that could be really cool. Awesome. Yeah, I think it'd be fun.
I love that idea. I know we talked to Adam Klofenstein. He's one of the top prospects in the Blue Jays system right now. And he actually played in the COVID league, right, that Roger Clemens put on to help some of the guys get some innings in. And he was telling us that he's like, man, Clemens can still throw. He's like, Clemens could still play. He's like, so
I'm sure. Yeah.
It would be cool to see some of these guys, you know, that are like, you know, 45, 50 and have been retired 10 years, but still have baseball running through their veins.
Yeah. Well, I bet you could put a team together of recently retired players that could have a good season in the big leagues right now. Yeah. I mean, you don't realize, you know, how many good players just decided, you know, they're done, but there's always, you know, a good 20 players or something that could have a job right now.
Agreed. Okay, so going back to listener questions here, Samantha in Vancouver says, "Hey, Sean, big fan. You've played with a lot of amazing players in your career, but from your time specifically with the Blue Jays, who was the best position player you played with and the best pitcher?"
That's a good question. So I think I played with some great pitchers there. So that's a hard question. I mean, Clemens had two incredible years. I thought Carpenter, when I faced him, was probably the toughest right-handed starting pitcher that I've faced because his stuff is really electric. I mean, it's hard to go. And Haken won the Cy Young. I love Pat. Pat's awesome. I would say probably it's hard to go past Clemens because he was so dominant.
Yeah.
for 2 straight years. Position player there, and I played with Robbie and. Hard to pass on Robbie, but you know, that was towards when I was with him full time, it was 95. And that was, you know, he wasn't playing quite to the same level he did, you know, 92, 93, but he was still great. But I would say offensively, Delgado was pretty incredible. I mean, he was, you know, the most dangerous hitter, I think, that I played with. The guy you didn't want to face, you know, if you're on the other team, it was Carlos.
So this kind of plays on that question here. It's from Jared in Whitehorse, Yukon. So that's way up north here in Canada. And he was wondering, sorry, I'm just losing it here. He says, there it is. Sorry. You've experienced both the LA and the New York baseball markets, two of the best in the game. How does the Toronto market stack up in your opinion? And what are some of the things that stand out to you from your time playing in Canada with the Jays?
Yeah, I mean, the Toronto market's great. And I think it's gotten a lot better too. I mean, it seems like it's a lot louder in the stadium, you know, when I've gone back over the years. But I would say when I played there, I felt like the Blue Jay fans were, it was more like, it was kind of like the Cubs, where they really love, you know, Cubs fans love the Cubs. And the Blue Jay fans love the Blue Jays, absolutely love the Blue Jays. And I think at that time, it wasn't as much of a love of baseball as it is now, right? I think it was more, we love the Jays. And right. I think it's, you know, it's been, what, 25 years or whatever since, you know, I came up there. And I think baseball is becoming more and more ingrained. There's a lot of great Canadian stars that have come into the league and are still in the league. So I think that's kind of how I would compare the difference is it's a love. It was more of a love for the Jays. Now it's becoming, you know, probably the second in terms of national pastimes up in Canada behind hockey. But the fans are great, and they keep getting more and more knowledgeable because the fans now have played baseball growing up. Whereas when I was there, probably not as many played growing up.
That's very astute. And I see it too, even like as a kid growing up, it was all Jays. Everyone was a Jays fan, not necessarily a baseball fan, but you just see the fandom for the game has grown a lot here.
Yeah. And just great people. And I think that's part of growing as fans is to know, you know, kind of when to get loud and when not. Whereas, you know, in New York, or I mean, their fans are, it's loud. Like you're in the postseason there. It's like you have chills. But I think the last time I went to a game, this was maybe 3 years ago. And I think maybe it was like the last team that, you know, was really good before COVID year. And the fans were loud. Like it felt a lot more like an East Coast, you know, fandom than it did. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. So Derek in Panama, because we do have listeners that are Jays fans that are kind of expats all over the world. So this is from Derek in Panama. And he says, "Hey, Sean, I read and enjoyed your book, Finding Stillness at 95 Miles an Hour, when it came out. I'm curious how the book came about and how it was received by your peers, as I know you were very honest about some of your relationships, like with Cito Gasson in it. And do you have any plans on another book down the road?"
Yeah, no, I've enjoyed it. No plans on another book, but no, it's something I wanted to write. I kept a lot of notes when I played, and you know, it was really more about, it's kind of more like the Eastern philosophy that you know, helped me, you know, throughout my career, and you know, how that impacted my play and my approach to baseball and approach to life. And you know, I wouldn't say I was necessarily critical of, you know, Cito and others. I just told the story, and it was more like, you know, Cito and I didn't, you know, we didn't see eye to eye on things. And, you know, I was a young player, and, but what the way that I hope it came off in the book is, you know, that helped me actually, because that's sort of made me become a man and have to, like, you know, have some, you know, just to believe in my own approach and to really draw a line in the sand. So those types of things, it's just part of a learning experience. So there's no like hard feelings or anything like that. And that's, you know, kind of how I try to portray in the book, but I like to write, and I actually had someone that I said, hey, he was a writing professor at a local college that was a friend. And I said, hey, do you want to help me, you know, with a book proposal? Cause you have to write out the proposal first. And he said, yeah, you know, I'll help you. And then, you know, we did it, and he actually liked we worked well together, and he liked the arc of the story. And so I said, hey, do you want to co-author with me? And he said, yeah, I actually would. And so the way we did it is I'd write, you know, we discussed the chapter and I'd write it, and then he would, you know, help craft it and make it better. And then while he was doing that, I'd write the next chapter. So it was kind of a fun process. It was a lot of work, and you know, I don't foresee writing another one, but it was definitely an experience, you know, kind of a bucket list thing that I wanted to see if I could do. And it was fun to do.
Not a lot of people have written a book, man. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was a good experience for sure. I'm proud of how it turned out. I think, you know, a lot of players actually have referenced it to me and said it helped them. And that's, you know, that's pretty gratifying to know that, you know, these experiences that I had and kind of articulating them in a certain way will be helpful to other players.
Totally. So Terry in Kelowna, BC, so Western Canada, says, hello, Sean. I was telling my son about how dominant you and Delgado were in the middle of the Jays order in the late 90s. You saw him up close and personal. How good was Carlos Delgado, and are you two still in contact?
Yeah, the guy just got here. Can you pause it and we
come
back into that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll be right back. Hang on. Sorry. Someone's getting the door. All right. You want to repeat the questions? We can cut it in.
do you want the question again here?
Yeah, I heard it, but I'll
give it to you again. So Terry in Kelowna, hello, Sean. I was telling my son about how dominant you and Delgado were in the middle of the Jays order in the late 90s. You saw him up close and personal. How good was Carlos Delgado, and are you two still in touch?
Yeah, Carlos, he's like a brother to me. We, you know, we still talk and text, you know, on a regular basis. And, I roomed with him at certain points in my career. He taught me how to do laundry, I think, when I was like 19 years old. He's an incredible guy and super, super smart guy. And yeah, he is very dominant, and yeah, you know, I owe a lot to him in terms of learning how to hit and hit for power. He's a fun guy, but he's very smart, and he's kind of like a no BS type guy, like, you know, get stuff done and do it the right way, treat people the right way. And that's pretty much it. But, I still see him, you know, every 4 or 5 years, one of us will be either in Toronto, we'll be in Toronto together, or, you know, if he's out in LA for something, or we're both in New York or whatever it is, we'll see each other. And that's always just like old times for sure. I mean, we played almost 10 seasons together.
Yeah.
You know, both in Toronto and New York.
I love that you two are still close. I guess there's something to be said for that relationship where you kind of come up with a guy, right? Like, your same experiences in a lot of cases.
Yeah. And I still talk to Alex Gonzalez occasionally too. Nice. I mean, text more, but, yeah. So we said, that's the thing about Toronto is, when Pat Gillick and Gord Ash were there, they wanted to not just get good players, they wanted good people. And that was important to them. And, you know, it was even in the minor leagues where you get a lot of knuckleheads and stuff, like there was, you know, really, really good guys. And, I think that's something that's the reason why the Blue Jays were the class of baseball for, you know, 10, 15 years, really. I mean, from the 80s all the way through the 90s, there was a lot of successful teams, but also like a lot of great guys that went on to other teams to have mm-hmm. great careers. You know, a lot of great players came through the Blue Jays organization and knew how to play the right way and how to treat people well.
100%. I think it's why the fan base is so solid these days, is that, it's just, if you grew up with baseball from the 80s and 90s in Canada, like, you were really treated to some pretty special players.
Yeah. Yeah. And I still see, you know, when I come up there, you know, I'll see guys like Mosby and Barfield. And I mean, they're great guys. And, you know, Mosby was a coach as well for us. But, you know, Garth Orge, a lot of them have been around the organization for years and still come back. You know, everyone loves playing in Toronto. I know visiting players love coming up to Toronto. It's, you know, it's, if you're going there for two or three road trips a year as a player, you always look forward to going to Toronto. And that's what you hear when you're playing against them. It's just a great city, and you like going places where, you know, the fans are, they're going to be good, but they're going to be fair, but they're, you know, they're not just going to be, you know, it's me getting abused the whole game. Right. Yeah. I mean, sometimes that could get old, but in Toronto, you're going to have a good experience for sure.
Right. Yankee Stadium is impressive and all great to experience, but you know, you get shit.
Yes. Without a doubt.
All right, Sean, last question here. And thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah.
You have a lot of fans here in Canada, and we appreciate your time and your candor. This is from Malik in Vancouver. And he says, Sean, hope all is well with you and the family. Curious, throughout your big league career, who the best pitcher you ever faced was?
Yeah, the hardest guy for me was Mariano Rivera. I think you'd ask most lefties of that era.
Yeah.
And he was, yeah, we had guys like Jose Cruz and I think Tony Fernandez sometimes hit right-handed against him, even though they were switch hitters. But he just had it was like an optical illusion. Like there's nothing you could do with that cutter that he threw. And I faced a lot of good, it's kind of weird for me. I faced a lot of great pitchers. I tend to hit those guys better, but it was like the number three or four starter that sometimes gave me more trouble. Like we go to Arizona when I played for the Dodgers, and I hit Randy well, I hit Schilling well, but then Miguel Batista, who's a J at one point, you know, he threw a good cutter, and I didn't like hitting off of him. So a lot of times I liked hitting off the better pitchers because they were pretty consistent. They had so much success with what they were trying to do that you kind of knew what they're going to do, and they didn't necessarily, you know, bear from it too much because it was playing into my strengths. They pitched to their strengths, and you know, if I like to hit off Braves pitchers, they like to stay away. So I hit Maddox and Smoltz and those guys well. But guys who threw good cutters,
which everyone
in, like,
can say. I mean, this is just, there's a long lineup of guys.
No, it was just kind of, it's just for some reason, I don't know, maybe I got a little more focused, but I don't know, whatever it was. Because when you think about it, pitchers who aren't successful, they're maybe effectively wild or throwing the ball, you know, not where they want to. And as a hitter, you know, I was very, it was very much a chess match for me. I tried to understand what pitches I wanted to hit, and I kind of knew, you know, if they were behind in the count, what they wanted to throw, if they were ahead in the count. So I kind of knew that stuff, and I think better pitchers were easier to figure out in that way than a pitcher that was a little more erratic, right?
Makes all the sense in the world, my man. Thank you so much, Sean. Honestly, it was such an honor to get to talk to you, and for you taking the time to chat some ball with us Blue Jays fans. Very much appreciated.
No, it's a pleasure. And yeah, I love the Blue Jay fans and love it when I get a chance to come up there. And especially now, it's a good young team. So I think it's going to be a good era of Blue Jay baseball.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! With a drive. Cheese and crackers. Shows to pitch to him.
Thanks for listening.